Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Many of these chicken breeds now are becoming less and less common, and I love it that if somebody wants to come and buy some of my birds, they'll go home and perhaps raise them, and they'll continue the beauty of this breed.
Which is why Jana Wilson is concerned that many of the poultry shows she attends are getting canceled, because that's where she sells her birds. She'll tell us how else the fallout from the avian flu outbreak has affected her chicken operation. Researchers are rating farm chemicals on how likely they are to cause cancer. That's from Harvest Public Media. Ag desk jobs are on the rise. And then a couple recipes today, one for pickled eggs and another for flan. 3 headlines with Mark Chilla.
The biggest news of the week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that would bypass states' mandatory labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms. Supporters like the Grocery Manufacturers Association and other food companies say that mandatory GMO labeling confuses customers and that genetically modified foods are safe. Opponents have dubbed the bill Deny Americans the Right to Know, or the DARK Act. They say the bill will likely be stalled in the Senate. If this bill becomes a law, it will make Vermont's labeling law and others like it void. It will require a new certification process for any foods labeled GMO-free. There will also likely be a trickle-down effect on other FDA processes, like more oversight into how the term natural is used. The Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015 passed the House 275-150. The wage board, appointed by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, has recommended the minimum wage be raised to $15 an hour for fast food employees. The final move before it becomes official is for Acting State Commissioner of Labor Mario Mussolino to accept it, which he is expected to do. Fast food employees have been fighting for the hourly wage to increase to $15 an hour, a jump from the current minimum wage of $8.75. It could put pressure on other low-wage hourly jobs, like retail, to increase their wages voluntarily. Employees of McDonald's, Burger King, Domino's, Wendy's, and KFC have rallied for higher wages since November of 2012. And the USDA has not reported any new cases of avian influenza since June 17th. The drop-off in outbreaks is likely due to hot weather suppressing the virus and wild birds hunkering down for the summer. Nevertheless, state and county fairs across the country have shut down poultry competitions to keep the virus from jumping between farms. State fairs in Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, New York, Ohio, and Nebraska have all banned poultry shows. Indiana initially banned all birds from fairgrounds, but recently lifted restrictions on parrots, canaries, and other songbirds, as well as doves and pigeons. Federal and state officials are bracing for a possible return of avian influenza in the fall, as warm summer temperatures provide a lull in the number of reported cases. Agriculture officials say cooler temperatures and southbound birds will likely bring fresh outbreaks. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack told Congress this week that a bird flu vaccine tested 100% effective for chickens in tests and is now being tried on turkeys. However, some officials have raised concerns that the use of the vaccine could trigger bans on U.S. poultry. Read more from our reporters Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie at eartheats.org.
We posted all sorts of news stories and conversations and recipes on Twitter. Check that out at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla with the food headlines. Thanks.
Anytime.
Farmers are in a never-ending battle with weeds. Their main weapons are chemical herbicides they spray on the unwanted plants. But could exposure to those chemicals cause cancer? Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on what scientists have to say about two of the most heavily used farm chemicals.
Nathan Dorn is scouting for weeds in a strip of grass between a field of corn and a field of soybeans. He rips a leafy green stalk out of the ground by its roots.
Pigweed. This is pigweed.
Dorn farms with his family here in southeast Nebraska. And one thing he says the family won't tolerate is weeds.
You break it apart there. You know, what do you see there? What is that?
It's wet.
Yeah, that's moisture. I mean, that's moisture that this plant's using to grow that that's not in there for my corn, not in there, not in the ground for my soybeans.
That's why before he plants his crop, Dorn sprays the field with a herbicide cocktail. Each acre is sprayed twice, some three times, to wipe out weeds. Corn and soybean farmers in the U.S. put down more than 300 million pounds of herbicide each year to keep their fields clean.
You know, you got to make sure that you have crops in your field and not weeds, because weeds don't end up in the combine bin. Weeds don't pay the bills.
But is all that spraying safe? In the last few months, scientists from around the globe weighed in on two of the most important herbicides to U.S. farmers, glyphosate and 2,4-D. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, is part of the World Health Organization. IARC brings in scientists to evaluate data on different chemicals and decide if there's evidence they could cause cancer. They looked at glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup, and determined it probably could cause cancer. For 2,4-D, which has been on the market since the 1940s, the group said it was possible the chemical could cause cancer. Environmental groups want regulators in the U.S. to take notice. Here's Scott Faber of the Environmental Working Group.
IARC is the decision-making body to which every regulator around the world looks to.
IARC doesn't regulate herbicides itself, but the agency's decisions do carry weight. Brazil is taking another look at glyphosate. It was already under review in this country by the Environmental Protection Agency. Farmers fighting herbicide-resistant weeds likely will look to spray more chemicals, not less. That's why Faber says the EPA needs to take IARC's conclusions into account when deciding how much is safe, both for farmers and their neighbors.
There are millions of rural residents who use playgrounds and go to school or go to church within the drift zones of corn and soybean fields.
But the EPA doesn't look at herbicides the same way as IARC. Take the case of 2,4-D. Anna Claire DeRousse is an epidemiologist at Drexler University and was a member of the 2,4-D group at IARC. She says the group's job was only to ask whether a chemical is a potential hazard.
Is there enough evidence to say that this agent or chemical causes cancer? And if so, what types of cancer is there sufficient evidence for?
So 2,4-D is a possible carcinogen, but so are coffee and aloe vera, according to IARC. The EPA's job is to determine whether it's likely to cause cancer or if there's a safe way to use it in the real world.
They also try to characterize what is the dose response, how much exposure do you need in order to develop cancer.
Julie Goodman is a toxicologist and consultant who works with the chemical industry. She says 90 government agencies around the world have done risk assessments on 2,4-D and found it safe to use.
Farmers or anyone else using or potentially exposed to 2,4-D should really rely on the results of the risk assessments. And as I said, these risk assessments demonstrate that 2,4-D does not increase cancer risk.
In the end, the real risk from any chemical is tied to the dose. That's up to the EPA and farmers like Nathan Dorn. He's comfortable following EPA guidelines, and that means he'll keep using chemicals like glyphosate and 2,4-D as long as they keep killing weeds.
It's effective, and you know what you're going to get. Right or wrong, it works.
For now, those tools will stay in his toolbox, at least until the EPA releases its review of glyphosate. That's expected to come out this summer. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, ag jobs for people who don't want to get their hands dirty are on the rise. Another story from Harvest. Jana Wilson is known in the community as a chicken expert. If you've got a question about your backyard flock, give her a call. When she was on her way over to the Earth Eats studios to talk to me the other day, she received an especially timely call.
I get this call and my friend says, I have a question about avian influenza. And it was just, whoa, well, that's interesting.
Because that's what was on our mind today, too.
Her situation, her description of what happened is not uncommon. She has a friend who lives in town, has maybe three or four chickens, and has one who's sick. And her concern was, because she's heard so much on the news about avian influenza, she was concerned that perhaps her bird might have that, and it's kind of frightening to some people.
She assured her friend that this chicken was probably not sick with avian flu, because as we heard in the news update, the USDA has not reported any new cases since June 17th. But chicken farmers, large and small, are trying to figure out what this means for their upcoming plans. like the fall poultry show circuit. Jana raises two types of chickens, Sicilian buttercups and Anconas, and she sells them at poultry shows around the Midwest. The chicks she had hoped to sell this year hatched in the spring, as avian flu was wreaking havoc on large chicken farms around the Midwest. Back then, it didn't occur to her that the outbreak would affect her plans later in the year. But then news started trickling in from poultry shows. Many are canceled.
The largest one of the year that I usually go to is in Ohio. It's called the Ohio National. That's a huge show in Columbus, Ohio, with like 6,000 to 7,000 birds. As of now, that show will not be taking place. And that's big.
She usually attends about 5 shows a year.
It's a very loud, noisy beauty show. It's a beauty pageant, really. People will bring their best birds, the ones that they have decided are the best representatives of that species. And a judge will go up and down and look at our birds and decide which one is the best representative of its breed and then perhaps of its type and class.
There's a sale portion of poultry shows usually, and that's where Jana gets to talk to farmers about her rare birds. Buttercups are listed as a threatened breed by the Livestock Conservancy, and Anconas are on the watch list. She's not in it for the money, she says. What she does want to do is recruit other backyard chicken farmers to breed her birds. Off the top of her head, she knows of only 5 serious breeders of Sicilian buttercups in the U.S.
I'm very interested in continuing the breeds. Many of these chicken breeds now are becoming less and less common. And I love it that if somebody wants to come and buy some of my birds, they'll go home and perhaps raise them, and they'll continue the beauty of this breed. But that, too, I don't know what's going to happen with that. Even if shows are allowed, I don't know if they'll continue to have the sale areas. So that certainly presents a problem when you've hatched a lot of birds and are expecting people to buy them for the enjoyment of the beauty of your birds.
She usually sells 40 to 50 of her birds every year. This year, she's not sure if she'll sell any. In the meantime, she's taking precautions on her farm to make sure her birds stay safe. First step is keeping wild birds out, since officials say they are responsible for spreading avian flu.
And they also just love to fly in and eat my chicken food. So for all but my largest pen, I cover my smaller pens with netting. And that actually keeps out predators as well. I also, for biosecurity reasons, I don't often let people come to my place and walk in my chicken pens because you can have diseases, organisms, viruses on your shoes. I also have a special pair of shoes that I wear only out in my pens. Those are my chicken shoes. And that's something that the USDA and you know, national experts have advised for a long period of time.
Jana will also have to change her record-keeping practices.
For all livestock currently, except poultry, there's a requirement that you have to keep records of who you sold your animals to, your name, the number of animals, the ages, the sex, things like that. That is now being extended permanently to poultry. That even after any avian influenza goes away, that will be something that now, as a breeder and a person who sells, anyone who sells birds will have to keep records. And it's not a huge deal, but it certainly is something you have to think about.
We'll bring Jana Wilson back in the fall to see if she sold any of her birds. You can read her posts about raising chickens on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, we'll cook with eggs, and making caramel is not for the faint of heart.
And that's why you have to push it to dark. If not, you wind up with a really weak caramel sauce that you come to regret.
Chef Seth Elger gives us confidence to make a great dessert just ahead. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan with Earth Eats. Hello. Chicken farmers love these long summer days. It's when their hens lay the most eggs all year because, did you know, egg laying is tied to the amount of light the chickens are exposed to. They need 14 hours of light every day to be consistent with their egg production. Jana Wilson, for instance, says she's getting over a dozen eggs a day right now. So you need recipes that go beyond omelets and souffles. We gotcha. The saying goes that the 100 folds in a chef's hat represent the 100 ways to cook an egg. We'll start off with two of the more basic ways to cook an egg.
We've spent a lot of time and a lot of energy mastering the soft boil.
Chef Seth Elger of No Coast Reserve.
There's just something to a set white and then that beautiful sauce-like texture of the properly runny yolk.
How long does he cook his soft-boiled eggs? It depends.
You have to get to know your egg source. On average, you're looking at like 6 to 6.5 minutes, depending on how hardy, how thick the shell is on the egg. So there's a little bit of variation there. You just have to dial it in. And the key for anyone who wants to do it with regularity is to always get the same eggs.
Good tip from Seth. He'll be back in a bit to make a custard dessert that uses 4 eggs. In another kitchen now with Chef Bob Adkins of Farm Bloomington, he's making hard-boiled eggs for pickling.
I always remember my grandmother having a big jar of pickled eggs with beets, and there were these bright pink pickled eggs and the pickled beets all in there. And it's something I really enjoy, something that you used to see a lot of times, you know, in bars and old saloons and stuff like that. And they're really easy to do.
There are really only 3 steps to this recipe: cooking the eggs, preparing the brine, and then waiting. I was surprised to hear that I've been boiling eggs all wrong my entire life. Chef Adkins has some pro tips.
There's really only one surefire way I've ever known to boil eggs. And boiling is a misnomer, because really you want to simmer. If you're boiling, you're agitating, you're breaking shells. So you start with 30 eggs in a pot large enough to hold them. Cover them by at least 2 to 3 inches of cold water. Put them on a high heat. You bring them up to one boil. You turn off the heat. Cover them. Let them sit off the heat for 10 to 15 minutes. After that, some ice water to shock the eggs. So while the eggs are coming up, you can prepare your brine. So I have 8 cups of malt vinegar. To that, I'm going to add some fresh ingredients. I've got 1 large Spanish onion, 2 jalapenos sliced down. The size doesn't really matter. So it's just you're lending the flavor to it. Some garlic, which is going to give it a different type of spice. We're also going to add some red crushed chili flakes. We're adding about 1/4 cup of fennel seeds, about 1 tablespoon of dried oregano, some whole black peppercorns, a little fresh rosemary and thyme, about 3 sprigs of rosemary and 6 sprigs of thyme, a few bay leaves, one of our all-time favorites in pickling. We're going to add 1/4 cup of kosher salt all to the mix there. And you could add other things to this. I mean, really, the sky's the limit. Right now, I'm waiting for the brine to come up and heat up a little bit for all those flavors to marry. We boiled and peeled the eggs, of course, or simmered the eggs. We're going to cut a little slit in a crosshatch pattern on the egg, just down to the yolk, so that it's going to allow that pickling brine to penetrate a little bit quicker. So we're going to do that to all of our eggs. I'm going to pour the hot brine directly over, and I have here just a stainless steel soup tureen, and then you can transfer them to something else after they've cooled. These will be ready in 2 days minimum. I would love to let them sit a week, and they're going to last a long time under refrigeration in that pickling brine. They've got, and the longer they sit, I think the better they get.
Bob Adkins' recipe for pickled eggs at eartheats.org. Technology has drastically changed farming. Modern tools have reduced the number of people needed to work in the fields, while at the same time creating new jobs in town. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer met some people who aren't farmers, but who work jobs directly tied to agriculture.
Heath Gerlach had been away from the family farm for 10 years, working in website and software development. Then a phone call lured him back, sort of.
My brother called me and asked me if I could set up a website where farmers would pay $1,000 a year to find good deals on hybrid seed. I said to him immediately, I could do that, but why would I do that?
The idea was that collating data for farmers would save them time and money. And that got Gerlach thinking about merging his high-tech world with his family's farm.
So, you know, this little orange box, 5 inches square, 1.5 inches thick.
Running a 21st century farm is complicated. Beyond operating a tractor and a combine, today's farmers need to manage all kinds of information. Huge companies and startups alike are investing in ag technology and, in the process, creating new jobs. That's why Gerlach founded FarmMobile.
This one's actually seen a little action. It's got some dirt on it there.
Okay. The device plugs into farm equipment and collects many types of data. Gerlach says eventually his customers will make money selling access to their farm data. Coming from a farm family, he says, gives him an edge when he approaches farmers.
There's a notion of wanting to preserve the spirit of what makes agriculture so wonderful. And the industry is so driven by trust. It's so driven by relationships, hardworking people.
People who can't always take on additional duties that crop up. These days, many farms are multi-million dollar businesses. They're often run by just a couple of family members without the managers and executives that other businesses might have. Karen Kearns recognizes that many larger farms want help with some aspects of running the business.
Our producers get so much data and so much communication beyond just how to produce pigs that they can't manage it. It's not enough for them to be great producers anymore.
She and her husband run Kearns and Associates in Ames, Iowa, which offers producers a menu of professional services such as human resources, strategic planning, even family counseling.
We actually sit down with them and help them with family dynamics. We have some families we work with where people haven't spoken in 10 years, but they work side by side.
What happens on the farm is now of more interest to people far away. Consumers are demanding to know more about their food, where it comes from, and how it was grown or made. That's changed how ag companies talk to the public.
For 54 years, we've been producing milk.
At Morgan Myers, a marketing firm in Waterloo, Iowa, Janine Stewart is watching a video that's featured on a website the company developed.
Now we're milking 145 registered Holsteins. That's the black and white cow.
Stewart says her firm used to connect ag companies to farmers. Now they create more projects aimed at the rest of us, too. Years ago, she preferred to hire employees with ag in their background. She grew up on a hog farm.
But we also have hired and are looking for people who are great communicators, creative thinkers, people who have an interest in the whole food chain and what's going on related to that, but they don't necessarily have to have that farm production background.
Federal reports show traditional farm labor jobs are on the decline. But work in agriculture-related businesses, especially for those with a college degree, is booming. Jonna Decker knows this. She graduated from Iowa State University this year with a degree in agricultural communications. She grew up on a dairy farm.
I knew I wasn't going to be able to go back to the farm because I have two brothers who are going to take over that someday. So I had to kind of segue into what I knew I wanted to do, which was stay true to my agricultural roots.
After getting into law school, she says she may focus on agricultural law.
It'll be interesting to see where I decide to take my career someday. Who knows? I'm still baffled by the amount of opportunities I have.
Eventually, Decker will likely join the ranks of others who have forged agriculture careers off the farm. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Our flan is, it's very basic flan. It's eggs, a little bit of half and half, and milk, sugar, and fresh vanilla bean. There's a little bit of sea salt in there, too.
Seth Elger in his kitchen at No Coast Reserve. A nice dessert recipe for us today. First off, for the flan, and most importantly, he's making caramel sauce. It's simple, three ingredients. The tricky part is cooking it just right and daring to let it get dark.
It's just sugar and a little bit of water to get started, and then when we get the color that we want, I'm going to add just a little bit of salt to it, but if you add it too early, it's going to want to encourage the sugar to go back into a granular state, which we don't want. We want it to
to stay in the liquid until we get the right color. As you can see, we're starting to get a little bit of color here. This is approaching an amber syrup. We're going to take this to a pretty dark caramel before we call it quits. Smells like it's getting a little bit bitter, but that's what we want. Oh, yeah. That is the finished color we're looking for.
It's almost, it looks like chocolate. It's so dark.
Yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of, like, overly sweet things. So when I make caramel, I go for dark. And we're going to put a good quarter inch of this in the bottom of the ceramics here. Then later on, we're going to, after it hardens, we'll pour a little bit of our custard mix onto it. And then we're going to bake it in a water bath, cover it up with a little bit of parchment foil so it steams. And as your custard cools, the sugar is going to pull liquid out of your custard, and it's going to make the caramel sauce in the bottom of the ceramic crock.
This is a make-ahead dessert because after they cook, the cups of flan need to set in the fridge for a couple days. Seth knew we were coming, so he had one ready for us to try.
So when you turn out a flan, a finished chilled custard, you're just inserting a paring knife to the side, spinning the crock. Once you've gone all the way around the outside, we invert it on a plate here, give it a little jiggle, and it'll turn right out.
That was so amazing, the goo at the bottom just all over top of that thing.
And a proper flan, the bottom, which then becomes the top when you invert it, should be stained.
Okay, I'm trying to get as much of the caramel in here as possible. Oh, man. That caramel is just...
That's why you have to push it to dark. If not, you wind up with a really weak caramel sauce that you come to regret.
A no-regrets flan. Maybe that's what we should call this recipe. See it in all its gooey glory on our website, and a special online-only recipe from Seth, another gooey dessert, a cuatro leches cake with caramel goat cheese sauce. That's at eartheats.org. Thanks to our two chefs today, Bob Atkins and Chef Elger. Our regular Earth Eats crew includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another week in the bag. Thanks, everyone. I'm Annie Corrigan.